This episode contains the topics of child sex abuse, pedophilia, and murder. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Momicide Podcast. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Kristen.
And in today's episode, I will be telling Kristen the story of Holly Jones. On a spring evening in 2003, 10-year-old Holly Jones walked her friend home after they had had a playdate at her house. Holly spoke with her friend's mother before heading back to her family home, which was in the same neighborhood, but she didn't make it there. This was completely out of character for Holly. And her disappearance, which happened in broad daylight, led to the issuing of an Amber Alert. News stations, billboards, and radios around the province spoke of the missing girl, and a massive search began. Hundreds of community members and investigators began helping in the search to find Holly, and eventually to find the man that Holly's mother referred to as the monster. I'm going to quickly read a quote from the victim's mother. She says, quote, "Something like this to me is one in a million. To have something like this living in your area, nobody would ever know. I think 99.9% of the time, your area is pretty safe for your child at 6:30 in the evening. Nice and light outside to be coming home from just down the street from where you live. It should be safe. That particular day, I was doing up her buttons, the buttons of her sweater. She insisted that she wanted to walk this little girl home. I was a little bothered by it. I was definitely very uncomfortable about it. And I thought, when she gets back, I'm going to have a little talk with her, not to make any arrangements to walk any kids home. But she never did come back, so it was too late." End quote. Okay, so this case takes place in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And as you can tell by the intro, it is a very heavy one.
Mm-hmm.
And cases that discuss children are always the hardest to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have a follower specifically request this case who lived and grew up in the area. So this was really close to her heart.
Mm-hmm.
And we do always look for Canadian cases that are not as commonly covered. And that ticks those boxes as well. And it's just senseless and heartbreaking. And I hadn't heard of it before.
No, me either.
Which it wasn't that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
20 years or so ago.
Yeah, we have been actively avoiding the child abuse cases because I just cannot deal. But we all know it was bound to happen. Mm-hmm. So here we are. Brace yourselves. Hopefully it's not too bad. I don't know anything about this story, so.
It's bad. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I'll go into it mentally prepared. Yes. At least. Be prepared for lots of commentary for this one, I'm right. Sure.
Holly Jones was born on September 14th, 1992, to her parents Maria Jones and George Stonehouse. Her family lived in a neighborhood in Toronto, Ontario, in Canada, and she was a grade 5 student at St. Luigi Catholic School. She was the youngest of four children in her family. She had three older siblings, two sisters and a brother, Shauna, Natasha, and James. She was described as a happy, outgoing, lively, gentle, and caring girl. Holly loved music. She attended both guitar and singing lessons and loved to dance. She told her parents that she wanted to be a famous singer. Holly was also a dedicated student and athlete. She was on her school's basketball team and ran cross country. Here's a picture of Holly.
She's so cute. So this would have been around the time she went missing?
Right, yeah. She's about the same age as she was.
And she was how old?
10.
10? So young.
And really close to our ages now, because I was born in 1991.
Right. Yeah, I was born in 92, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy.
On the evening of May 12th, 2003, Holly was just 10 years old. She asked her friend Claudia to come over after school. At Holly's family home, she and her friend Claudia played chess and dress up before it was time for Claudia to return home for the evening. Although it was a cool, damp evening, it was still light out, and Holly told her friend that she wanted to walk her home. So apprehensively, Holly's mother zipped up her jacket over the dress-up clothes that she had left on, and Holly and Claudia set off on foot to Claudia's house, which was only a few blocks away. Upon arriving at her friend's home, Claudia's mother offered to walk Holly back to her house, but Holly said she would be fine. At 8 p.m., upon arriving home from running errands, Holly's mother panicked as she realized that her daughter was not home. She knew immediately that something was wrong. She called friends, searched the nearby neighborhood, and then quickly called the police. Police initially indicated that it was way too soon for Holly's mother to call, that Holly hadn't been missing for long enough to raise alarm bells, but her mother reiterated that she knew Holly was in danger and something needed to be done ASAP.
So, like, I understand, depending on how soon it would have been, I'm assuming it was within, like...
I would say not even an hour.
Right. So I can understand why the cause would be like, you know, it's a little soon, right?
Right.
But putting myself in that mother's shoes, can completely understand the frantic anxiety panic that you would be feeling.
Right.
And why wait? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, what is the point of waiting? Like, even if she's fine, even if she's just playing with friends or around the corner, send a fucking cop out.
Right.
If the cop has to pull her back or bring her back home, then so be it. But waiting and waiting and waiting for nothing to happen just seems so senseless to me.
I know. And she did, obviously, she called Claudia's mother. Claudia's mother confirmed that she had gone back home. She checked where she might have been. She checked across the street. She checked with her siblings to see if they had seen her, and nobody saw her.
Mm-hmm.
So she definitely ticked a lot of boxes first to cross off the obvious places where she could be. And then once you do that, of course, you're going to think, okay, something's wrong.
Right.
And she was right.
Yeah.
A frantic search began for the missing 10-year-old girl, with a command post being created in the neighborhood, with members of the community assisting in the search. 16 hours after Holly had gone missing, an Amber Alert was released, which at this time was the first Amber Alert released in Ontario. So apparently at the time, in order for an Amber Alert to be released, you needed specifics about a child being abducted, and they were abducted by someone, and there was a witness, and there's a car to look for, what have you, right?
Right.
They didn't know if she had been abducted,
mm-hmm.
but the Amber Alert was released anyway.
Okay.
So obviously it just contained details of what she looked like, because there was nothing else to go by.
Right. And back then, like, there weren't the alerts that are sent to your cell phone. So, like, what would the Amber Alert have been? Would it just been on, like, the 5 o'clock news or something?
Right. And radio stations.
Oh, okay.
And I'm assuming if there are any billboards in the area that might be televised, that they could send it to that.
So clearly, I mean, it seems at this point that they're taking it pretty seriously then.
They definitely
even
did.
Even though it's been 16 hours, like, for this to be the first Amber Alert and there's not even, like, a witnessed abduction, they're still sending one out. They clearly, you know, want to find her.
Right.
So.
And I know her mom fought really hard for that, too.
Yeah. Which you have to be, like, so vocal and advocate,
mm-hmm.
because
you have to be the one to care.
Yeah.
Detective Sergeant Dave Perry with the Toronto Police Sex Crimes Unit was assigned to Holly's case. He said, quote, "She had never gone missing before, which put the fear factor for us up significantly. There are two basic reasons children are abducted, and you hope that it's the first one, which is some type of family involvement. From history, you have a better chance of getting the child back successfully. On the other hand, if you get a child abduction, you have minutes to hours to get them back alive," end quote. Perry had dozens of officers on the case, and he told each of them that they needed to gain access to every residence on the route that Holly walked that evening, and to call him straight away if there was any resistance, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. This is how a missing children case should be handled.
Right. The next morning, so the following day after Holly's disappearance, Holly's mother, Maria, made an appearance on the news, hopeful that Holly might see her and see that everyone was working hard to find her. Maria said, quote, "Holly, honey, our hearts are out for you. Baby, if you can hear me, you know how much we love you. I feel you inside of me and I'm trying to find you. I'm doing everything, Everybody is working very hard, and whoever has her, I beg you. I beg you with all my heart that you keep her and you bring her home to her mother and father. You keep her safe. I beg you, she hasn't ever hurt anyone in her life. She is a happy girl. I beg you not to hurt her. Bring her home to us." End quote. There is a news clip of this, but I'm not going to play it. It's absolutely devastating, and she's sobbing.
Just gut-wrenching.
It's heartbreaking. Unfortunately, later that same day, a Ward's Island resident, who had been walking his dog at the time, made a grim discovery. He quickly called 911 to inform police that he had seen a suspicious black gym bag washed up on the shore, and after unzipping it, he was horrified to find a human torso inside.
No.
I know. And this is the next day. Following the discovery of the human remains, investigators conducted a thorough search of the surrounding waters, with divers being pulled underwater on sleds, searching for the possibility of another bag containing further remains. And later that day, investigators located a suitcase floating in Lake Ontario near the Canadian National Exhibition Grounds. Within the suitcase was a 5-pound weight, a sponge mop, and severed body parts. One of the body parts included a head, and police were able to confirm that they had unfortunately located the missing 10-year-old girl, Holly Jones.
Can you imagine how fucking traumatic that would be for the officers having to discover a child's severed head?
It's really, really unbelievable to disconnect yourself from this, but then to really think that through, that they saw that. Yeah. How would you ever get that picture out of your head?
We wouldn't.
These people are tortured souls.
Nobody should ever have to witness that. It's something you would never forget.
Yeah, I would say every single person involved in finding that and identifying that.
Especially with it being a child, too.
It's awful.
So how far apart were, like, the suitcases then?
Were the
gym bag and the suitcase?
They were a good distance apart.
They were in the same body of water,
right? They were in the same body of water. So it's not unreasonable to think that they could have been dropped in the same spot and one floated or drifted to the other spot.
Okay. So the second suitcase that was found had a 5-pound weight, but it was still found floating?
Yes, it was found floating, so it didn't successfully sink the bag.
Okay, so probably because the body parts were, like, bloating.
I would say that.
Which is also so fucking disgusting. Yeah.
But yeah, the 5-pound weight wasn't enough to keep the bag underwater.
That's sickening.
Holly's mother would later say that their family used to frequent Ward's Island for Holly's birthday each year. She said that Holly's dad believed that Holly, quote, went there to Ward's Island so we could find her, end quote. Speaking with the media after the discovery, just 24 hours following her disappearance, Staff Inspector Gary Ellis with the Homicide Squad announced, quote, "The search for Holly Jones is now the search for a killer," end quote. The family was brought into the station and they were told the news. Maria, Holly's mother, screamed and she was angry. She grabbed the investigator that had just told them the news and she shook him, saying, quote, "You have to tell me, was she raped?" End quote. And he nodded in response. Detective Constable Deborah Vitti, a member of the Sex Crimes Unit, was assigned as the family liaison for the investigation. She described a, quote, "colossal team of workers on the case that were determined to catch the man responsible for Holly's death and to bring as much peace and comfort to her family as possible." Deborah had become close with the family and knew so much about Holly Jones's life that she felt like she knew her. After Holly's remains had been found that day, Vitti recalls racing over to the Jones's home. She says, quote, "I was met with a house full of very anxious people who had come to know me by my first name. I think what kept me going was their loss. This tragedy that impacted the whole city was more important. If I felt tired or stressed, I just thought, handle it. Because this family has lost a little girl. Grandparents have lost a grandchild. Friends have lost a best friend. I'll get through this," end quote. Which I think goes well with what we were just talking about and how officers and investigators are able to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And like she said, yeah, this is hard for me, but think about how hard it is for them. And that's such a selfless thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be a quality that homicide detectives have.
Right, yeah.
Shortly after their discoveries, photos of the two bags, as well as the weight found within one of the bags, were released to the public in hopes of helping to find the perpetrator. Toronto police pleaded for help from the public in finding Holly's killer, and they were specifically looking for any witnesses who may have seen two men carrying the bags on the ferry or near the area where Holly's remains were found. One of the men they had been looking for was deemed suspicious, and he was brought in for questioning, and he was cleared as a suspect. The other man they were looking for was not identified. Just 5 days following, over 1,600 tips had been called in to police.
So how did they come to the assumption that it was two men?
I think that they reviewed CCTV footage, whether it be around the city or around the train station in Toronto, and identified two men that they thought may have been carrying bags similar to the ones that they had found.
Okay.
So one of the men was brought in and it wasn't him. He didn't have anything to do with it. And then the other man they never identified. With the remains of Holly Jones being found in the water, detectives were left with the question of how the perpetrator disposed of the body. Did he live on the island or nearby, or did he take the ferry from another location to dispose of the remains? Investigators questioned residents in the area of Ward's Island, but nobody living in the area saw anything. So at this point, they have no witnesses seeing anybody carrying the bags, no witnesses seeing anybody dispose of anything.
And sorry, remind me again how long it had been between the time she went missing to the time the body was found.
It was later the next day. So it was the day after she went missing. And at the time that they made the announcement that they had found her remains, it was exactly 24 hours later.
Oh, wow.
So it would have been like 6 p.m. the wow. next day.
Okay.
Which is pretty quick.
Yeah.
As previously mentioned, one bag of remains had surfaced near the mainland, and the other was found washed up on the beach. A marine specialist who studied wind and water currents was able to estimate that the bag of remains found at Ward's Island likely floated over from the mainland in only days. Just around the corner from the beach on Ward's Island is a lake, and if the bag had made its way to this lake, it may have never been found. So the fact that they washed up and the fact that they didn't sink is huge.
Mm.
Because without these remains, we will come to learn that they likely wouldn't have gotten anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
On June 5th, 2003, police released a computer-generated photo of Holly Jones wearing the clothes that she had worn on her walk that evening. Investigators also suggested that the perpetrator may reside in the area where Holly went missing. So this is less than a month later that they're releasing this. Steve Ryan, a lead investigator on the case, described the weeks after Holly had been abducted and killed, saying, quote, "The entire city was in lockdown. Kids were telling their parents that cars were looking at them suspiciously, so parents became guardians, calling in these, quote, attempted abductions, and everyone in the city became a detective. Everybody had someone in mind who they thought could have done this, and that is what we were dealing with. Which is a good thing," end quote.
You would just be on, like, hyper alert.
I wouldn't let my kid leave the house.
Yeah. I would be so paranoid and, like, yeah, just, like, every little last thing would trigger you to think that something terrible is happening again.
When you have the paranoia, the things that you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So there were so many attempted abductions reported following Holly's disappearance.
Right.
Because people were just, like you said, on high alert. Yeah. And just thinking the worst.
Mm-hmm.
The Toronto police continued to work tirelessly on Holly's case, with officers placed all over the city looking for the man responsible for her murder. The service in Holly Jones's memory was held at St. Vincent de Paul, which was the church where Holly had been baptized as a baby. The service was broadcast live. Holly's mother said that during the funeral, quote, "I caught myself looking up into the sky all the time, as if she could see me," end quote. So the first one is a picture of Holly's mother looking up at the sky during the service. And then in the second one, it's Holly's mother with her eyes closed, holding the hands of Holly's two other sisters. Her siblings were quite a bit older than her.
Okay.
So those are her two sisters, and then Holly's mother is in the middle.
The mom looks young. It looks like they could all be sisters.
Yeah, it does. After an autopsy was performed on Holly's remains, investigators were told that Holly had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death. On her body was the presence of green propylene fibers, likely from a bath mat or a carpet. The autopsy also confirmed the presence of male DNA under Holly's fingernails. She fought back and was helping to provide answers as to who did this to her. And we'll come to find out that this is also key.
Mm-hmm.
This male DNA was crucial. However, investigators still wondered whether it could conclusively lead them to Holly's killer. If the man was not already in the database, the search would not be of any help. And unfortunately, after comparing the sample to more than 70,000 convicted offenders within the National DNA Bank in Ottawa, no match was found. So really all this tells us is that it's not somebody who had been previously convicted.
Right, exactly.
Refusing to give up, Toronto police made the decision to carry out a DNA manhunt. A relatively unheard of process where all men within a 6-block radius of Holly Jones's home were contacted and asked to voluntarily provide a DNA sample in search for a match for Holly's killer. Volunteers simply had their cheeks swabbed, and when there was no match, they were cleared.
So I feel like if you have nothing to hide, you should be jumping at the opportunity to do this.
Right.
Because why not?
And you'll see that that whole idea is very important to the police.
Yeah.
Because you either give your DNA and you didn't do it, or you give your DNA and you did it, or you don't want to give your DNA. And why don't you want to give your DNA?
Because you're guilty of some shit.
Yes.
If it's not this, then it's something.
Exactly. Steve Ryan said, quote, "Civil liberties were concerned about what was going on, but the bottom line, we had a little girl who was brutally murdered and sexually assaulted. We had DNA. We had a proverbial needle in a haystack. We just needed to get all that hay, and it was done one by one, asking men to give a sample of DNA." End quote. So there were people complaining, obviously, as people do, because they complain no matter what, that this was violating civil rights, or this was violating something. But it's a voluntary. If you don't want to give it,
like, what the fuck is wrong with you? This is a child that we're talking about here, and you're going to sit here and complain about your rights being violated? Like, can we please, like, get a grip here?
Before the DNA analysis, police initially had approximately 468 persons of interest, which was then reduced to 19, and finally 3. Because out of the hundreds of men that stepped up to provide their DNA, 3 men refused to provide it. One person of interest, so one of these 3 men, was referred to as the Bleach Man. This man had a prior conviction regarding sexually abusing a child around Holly's age. He also lived only 2 miles from the Joneses' residence and had a vehicle. When investigators arrived at this man's apartment, they were overwhelmed at the smell of bleach. When they asked the man's consent for a DNA sample, he refused, and he actually slammed the door in the officers' faces. So, way to set a good example of yourself.
Yeah.
Investigators put 24-hour surveillance on this suspect, and they were actually able to obtain a DNA sample from an item that the man had discarded, and it was not a match to the DNA found under Holly's fingernails.
I love that the police are able to do this, just like stake out a place and be like, yeah, I'll just wait for you to throw that cup out, or yeah, like, I'll just wait for you to butt that cigarette out and just go and like pick it up. And be,
I know,
like,
it's amazing.
Gotcha.
It's like, what a true like investigative movie or film. Like, that's, yeah, what you picture.
I know.
The second person of interest was referred to as Workshop Man. So he was a man who resided directly across the street from the Joneses' family home. And investigators were aware that this man knew Holly. The police noted that this man's workshop had tools, obviously easily available to the man, that could have been used to dismember a body. This man also refused to provide a DNA sample, but again, through surveillance, they recovered an abandoned item, contained the man's DNA, and he was ruled out as a suspect as well.
And this is her neighbor.
This is a guy that lived across the street.
Who, like, would know that this poor family is, like, just lost a child, and you're still going to be like, no, I'm not going to give you my DNA. Like, go away. I'm not helping this case. Like, what a miserable human being.
It raises red flags for me.
Absolutely.
Big time. The final person of interest was 35-year-old Michael Briere. Briere also refused to provide a DNA sample, explaining that he didn't want to because, quote, "I feel that it puts the onus on us to prove we're not guilty, that Big Brother is watching us," end quote, as well as, quote, "there's too much government control," end quote.
Oh, here we fucking go. It puts the onus on us to prove we're not guilty? Yeah, that's the whole fucking point here.
Exactly.
And these government conspiracy theorists, like, right there, red flag. Immediately, red flag.
On top of this, while speaking with Briere, police also noticed that he had a green bath mat as well as a distinct color of carpeting within his home that matched the color of the fibers that had been collected from Holly's remains. They also noticed weights similar to the one found in the suitcase with Holly's remains. There were children's toys on the mantle in the living room, despite the fact that he had no children.
That's creepy.
Yep. And he also specifically said children don't come to visit.
So why the fuck do you have those?
Great question. And his apartment reeked of bleach. So red flag, red flag, red flag.
Mm-hmm.
And also kudos to these officers that took note of all of these creepy ass things on this list.
Yeah.
Finally, Briere also claimed to be home alone the evening of Holly's abduction, and so he was also not able to provide an alibi. But we have an issue because he would not give his DNA. With all of this information in mind, Michael Briere moved to the top of the suspect list, and investigators placed him under surveillance as well. In the days following, investigators made another stop at Briere's home and immediately noticed that the green bath mats were no longer there. And there were brand new bath mats along with a shower curtain sitting on his table. Michael Briere also had a lot of mood swings while he was speaking to the police, so he was sometimes super calm and cooperative with them, but other times he would get really angry and really escalate the situation.
Mm-hmm.
On one instance, he was brought into the station for an interview, and he willingly went, and he brought up DNA testing himself. And while chuckling, he said to one of the detectives, quote, "Well, I'm pretty sure the science works when they compare samples. That's what scares me," end quote. A detective also asked Briere about changes that he had made in his home, so I guess just generally asking him, have you changed your house up at all? And he told police that he did replace the bath mats and the curtain. When they asked him what color the mats were prior to him replacing them, he indicated that they were black.
And at this point, they're already aware that they weren't black.
They know they weren't black. They saw that they were green.
So, like, when somebody is acting this sketch and fucking suspicious, like, there's no way that you can now convince these officers that you're innocent.
Right.
Like, you're just too far gone at this point. And it's hilarious because he probably thinks that he's doing a great job.
Oh, probably.
Like, oh, I'm going to act really calm and I'm going to voluntarily go in and, you know, act like I got nothing to hide. And this entire time, the officers are looking at him like, buddy, like, you could not be acting any more fucking guilty right now.
Yep.
And you don't even know it.
While continuing to watch Briere around the clock, police saw him throw a can of Pepsi into a garbage bin on a side street. They waited patiently to swoop in to collect it. Within the garbage can were only two items, and both were identical cans of Pepsi, which, what are the odds? It was found that one of the cans was a match. Police continued to watch him, so they obviously needed another sample. So they continued to watch him, and then later that same day, he ate a meal at a food court at the Dufferin Mall, and police waited, and then they collected his cup and straw. So after collecting his DNA a second time, it was tested overnight that same evening, and by the morning, they confirmed that Briere's DNA matched that of the DNA found under Holly Jones's fingernails.
Next time I'm in the food court at a mall, I'm just going to be like, how many undercover officers are just sitting around watching people eat their meals?
Literally.
I'm just going to go over and, like, swipe this little cup here. No big deal.
And also watch to see if you see anybody, like, suspiciously taking all of their food items with them when they leave.
Yeah.
Like, you're up to something.
Good point.
Gary Ellis, the head of homicide at the time of Holly's murder, said, quote, "That was probably the best phone call we ever got. Holly provided that. There was an exchange between him and her, and that exchange was microscopic under her fingernails. That made the difference. His confession came only after the DNA," end quote. Following 40 days of painstaking, meticulous, and thorough investigation, 35-year-old Michael Briere was arrested on his way to work the morning of June 20th, just over 1 month after Holly was murdered. On this beautiful sunny morning, with the suspect in the back of his patrol car, Detective Perry said to him, quote, "Have a look out the window, because this is the last time you are going to see a sunrise like this," end quote.
So how close did he live to where Holly lived?
We will learn that.
Okay.
So here is quite literally the only photo of him that I can find on the internet.
Ew.
And here's another photo of, you can sort of see police just holding on to his photo where they had been distributing it.
Like, you know how some people have just like black eyes?
Yes.
Like black, empty, soulless eyes. It's the creepiest fucking thing.
He absolutely has those.
Like, it's actually scary when I see people like that, because I'm like, you are not human.
No. Holly's family was informed that there had been an arrest, and they felt relief. From the day that Holly had gone missing, members of the community left flowers, teddy bears, and angels outside of the Joneses' family home. A memorial park was also created in Holly's honor at a park just down the street, with a mural portrait of Holly and a small garden that was planted in her memory. So here are a couple of pictures here. So this is Holly's mother kissing her photo in front of her memorial. And then this is a picture of two little girls, 10 and 9 years old, that are writing messages on paper butterflies in front of the memorial painting.
That's heartbreaking.
I don't know if these girls were specifically her friends or if they lived in the area, but she obviously had friends, and for a child to go through this and lose a friend is...
I can't imagine.
After Michael Briere's arrest, investigators worked on a strategy for how they would get him to confess. They noted that Holly's legs were still missing, as they hadn't been recovered in either of the two bags. And this was an important piece of information. Obviously, a piece of information that only the perpetrator would know.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Ellis, who was one of the detectives conducting the interview, recalled seeing a photo of an older woman on the fridge during a prior visit to Briere's home. So during this visit, detectives asked him who it was, and he started to tear up and told them that it was his mother. So Detective Ellis thought that Briere's love for his mother might be a ticket to his confession. So he was sort of tugging on his heartstrings with this. And he said, quote, "I started talking about Holly, and I started talking about Holly's mother. I started talking about the fact that an added level of torture for Holly's mother is that we haven't been able to recover her legs. And I sort of said, quote, what would your mother be telling you to do right now? Wouldn't your mother be telling you to help these officers to give Holly Jones's mother some peace to help us recover her legs? And at that point, he looked up, and I knew I had him. And he finally sat up and he turned towards me and he said, quote, you'll never find her legs. I put them in the garbage. So I sat back and let him give me the longest, most graphic, and most detailed confession I'd ever taken in my entire career," end quote.
So did he actually do that? He put them in the garbage?
He did.
So why is he doing it that way? Like, I would think that that is an incredibly risky thing to do, like throw body parts in a garbage. Like, mm-hmm. Do you not think that there may be the possibility that a garbage man is going to see that as they're like dumping the garbage into the truck?
I don't know if he disposed of them in something, but the legs were actually never found.
God.
Because I think sometimes these things just end up in landfills.
Like, why not just throw them in the ocean or the lake with the rest of the stuff that you're doing? Like,
I think the assumption is that he was running out of time and couldn't take the legs. And so he just waited. I'm forgetting now if I say this or not, but I think that he didn't have the time to make another trip and was stressing out, panicked, kept the legs, then disposed of them. In his confession, Michael Briere told police that on May 12, 2003, just before 6 p.m., he was searching the dark web for child sex abuse material. Briere described this as, quote, his dark secret, saying, quote, I always had the fantasy of having sexual relations with a little girl, end quote.
Another one of these fucking freaks.
I know, I'm sorry. In an interview by the detective podcast, Steve Ryan, which, as I said before, who was a lead investigator on Holly's case, said, quote, Briere had consumed a lot of alcohol that afternoon, watched child pornography, and had decided he was going to act out a long-time fantasy of his, which was to abduct and sexually assault a young girl. And he was going to pick the first girl that he saw. So if it wasn't Holly, it would have been someone else, end quote. Briere actually told investigators that it came to a point where child sex abuse material did not work for him anymore. He felt as though he then had to escalate and actually have sex with a child.
Yeah, because that's how these things fucking work. Eventually, the...
You become desensitized to it.
Right. The release that you get no longer satisfies you anymore with that. And it always, always, always escalates.
And by you, we mean you sick fucks.
Yes.
Shortly after watching child sex abuse material, he said he was headed out for a walk and he couldn't believe it. He said, quote, I walked out and Holly was, I didn't know her. I'd never seen her before. It's just coincidence. If she wouldn't have been on the street corner, I probably would have just walked the street and just gone back home, end quote. He walked past Holly, peering around to see if anyone was watching, and then turned around and he darted directly towards her. He said, quote, As soon as I got right next to her, I grabbed her by the neck. She didn't scream. She was in total shock, end quote. Briere forced Holly into a nearby alleyway just behind his house, bringing her into his apartment. He removed both of their clothes and said that he, quote, tried to have sexual relations with her, but I never actually completed the act, end quote.
Yeah, fucking right, you didn't.
I know.
Like, he's just saying that because he knows how it sounds.
Yep.
And he doesn't want to, that's the only thing he can do, is the only saving grace he has at this point is, well, let me try to talk myself out of actually finishing the job, right? Yep. Like, I didn't actually climax. Mm-hmm. I attempted to, but no, I didn't actually do it, so I guess that makes me less bad. Like, that's not how it works.
And there was evidence,
right? And if you went through all this fucking trouble to act out your fantasy that you had been fantasizing for that long about, and you're going to sit here and tell me that you have this child now in your presence and you're not going to execute it the way that you've been wanting to execute it, like, fuck off.
Right. And it's just the fact that, I mean, does he think they're stupid? Obviously, police have a way of being able to tell if somebody was sexually abused. So who are you trying to fool? Just yourself?
I just don't get, like, what, like, as a pedophile, you must know that you are not well. Like, you have to know that.
I would hope so.
Like, you have to know that. The difference here is that they just don't give a fuck.
Right.
And they're willing just to go and, like, you know, be fucking monsters. But you have to know. So yeah. That alone, I would hope that there would be people out there who would just quietly walk off into the woods and fucking off themselves.
Right.
Instead of inflicting pain on other people in society, if you know you are fucking sick, and if you know that you have, you're that close to actually doing something as fucked up as that, just go take care of it.
Right. If you cannot control yourself, it's never going to be fixed.
Like, I just can't.
I would assume that there are people in the world who are attracted to children, if that's how you want to put it, who don't abuse children.
Yes. We've learned this.
Right.
By listening to Hunting Warhead. It's very controversial. It's really, really hard for me to wrap my mind around it, but it is proven that there can be pedophiles who don't act on their things and their fantasies.
Right. And I think, what is the terminology? There's two different terms. So we have pedophile, child sex offender, and minor attracted person sounds dumb as fuck.
What's the difference between that and pedophile?
So, obviously, the difference between pedophile and child sex offender are obvious.
Right.
A child sex offender is someone who has committed some sort of sexual offense against a child, and they could not be a pedophile, right?
Right.
A pedophile is a person who is specifically attracted to a child, and they could or could not act on it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this minor attracted person sounds like somebody trying to sugarcoat a pedophile.
Yeah, like I'm having a hard time grasping what the difference there would be.
I feel like it's not a term that is used, and it sounds like it was made up by pedophiles.
Probably.
So in this article, it says, actively avoiding terms such as pedophile, and it says that calling someone a pedophile stigmatizes child sex offenders and makes it less likely that they'll reach out for help. By contrast, treating these people with respect and providing them with support services benefits society. And so I guess that means using minor attracted people.
Yes, because I think in the podcast, it was how I remember it explained, is that these people are born attracted to children the same way somebody is born gay, attracted to the same sex.
Or born straight.
Right, exactly. And like I said, it's hard for me to grasp. Because obviously, you know, can't relate, but apparently this is a scientifically proven thing. As hard as it is to accept that, it's true. If somebody does have this quality where they are attracted to children and they know that and they're not acting on it, and in fact, they're actually seeking help with a therapist because they know how fucked up and wrong it is, I can respect that.
Oh, absolutely.
Because at least you have some fucking insight. Which I wish a lot more of these fucking weirdos would have. And you want to seek help because you know this is not, like, what the fuck is wrong with me? That's all I would think is, like, what the fuck is wrong with me? Like, I need a fucking lobotomy or something.
Yeah. Just,
you know what I mean?
Cut my brain in half.
Oh my fuck.
I think for me, it's really hard because being straight or being gay or being pan or whatever, those are things that are so, like, they're human and they're right and it's all is good. It's not hurting anybody.
Yes.
It is, like, it is what it is.
And, like, you're attracted to somebody.
You're in a consenting relationship.
Yeah, with another adult your same age. That's the difference.
But
here,
when you say, oh, they're a minor attracted person, like, why are you trying to normalize and humanize
exactly
something that is so insanely messed up?
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with it. Yeah. I'm sure there are people that might understand it. And like you said, if it is somebody who's actively seeking help and they can't control it, that good on that person. And I'm really sorry that that happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
But to the people that watch child sex abuse material and abuse children and sit around fantasizing about this all day and hurt people, you're a pedophile.
It makes me so sick. I can't even begin to get started on that makes me feel.
We won't. So Briere obviously lived along the route of where Claudia and Holly, between where they live.
Mm-hmm.
And his apartment was off of an alleyway. And essentially, I'm assuming his apartment may have had more than one door. But this door that was straight off the alleyway led right into his bedroom, and it was hidden.
Oh wow.
Which is really fucked up. And like, did he choose that spot? He was able to get Holly into his apartment fairly easily because of the alleyway. So just to recap, he brought her into his home. He claimed that he didn't have sexual relations with her. We obviously have the evidence that he did. Upon abducting Holly, Briere said that he knew that he wouldn't let her go alive. He said, quote, probably when I was walking her to my place, I think at that point I realized it's already too late. Already at that point, I didn't want to get caught. End quote.
So his fantasy was to abduct and sexually assault a child.
Right.
The fantasy didn't include killing a child.
The fantasy didn't. No, the killing aspect was so that he didn't get caught for doing it. What I'm about to say is really disturbing. So if you want to skip ahead like 20 seconds, you can. At one point during the abduction, Briere had thought that he had killed her, and he placed her body in the fridge. But shortly after, he heard a banging coming from inside the fridge, and it was Holly. He proceeded to remove her from the fridge, and then less than an hour after abducting her off the street, he strangled her to death.
What the fuck?
I know, I'm sorry. We don't even need to talk about that.
That's fucking horrifying. That poor child. The poor parents to fucking hear that. That is...
There's no words.
Like, just when I didn't think this man could get any more fucking evil, here we are.
And her mom talks about that. And she's like, my daughter died and that hurts. But to know the details of how she suffered, you could just never get that out of your head. And it would physically and mentally hurt you for the rest of your life.
It would destroy
you. To think about
you.
Those last moments.
It would absolutely destroy you.
After he had killed her, Briere indicated that he panicked, and he started searching for tools that he could use to dismember her body. He spent hours using a handsaw to break her body up into pieces and place them into two bags, a gym bag and a suitcase. Once finished, it took him two trips back and forth on the Toronto subway to transport almost all of her body parts to the Toronto harbor, where he discarded them. While on the subway, Briere indicated that a man sitting across from him looked startled, and as Michael looked down, he realized that there was blood leaking from the bag. He put his foot over the drop of blood, trying to cover it up and smear it. He told investigators that at this point, quote, I thought for sure I was caught, end quote. I wonder about this because it's like, did that person not see all the alerts in the news about somebody with a bag? And like, maybe he didn't see the blood and he was just paranoid and he thought the guy looked startled. But like,
yeah,
I question that.
But can you imagine, like, if he did see the blood, the thoughts that would immediately go through your head? I'm sure there's people out there who would see something like that and talk themselves out of whatever potential it could be, because it's too fucking horrifying to think that that it's actually real, right? Like,
oh yeah,
there would definitely be a split second go through my head where I'm like, no, like that's not blood. Like, what the fuck? Like, I'm like tripping out right now, and then just like distract myself with something else.
Mm-hmm.
But come to find out, this man, after the fact, knowing what he saw, the trauma you would live with that.
Yeah.
And then the guilt also for not calling it in.
Right.
Right. Like, and it just goes to show something as simple as that. Like, even if you think something, you know, maybe, oh, like maybe I'm overreacting, like maybe it's not that big of a deal, like, it never hurts to notify the police.
Right.
That's
doesn't.
Literally what they're there for.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not annoying them, you're not inconveniencing the police by saying like, hey, I don't know if I'm wrong or not, but like, here's what I saw and it seemed a little suspicious. Like, those tiny little things can help so much in the grand scheme of things with like catching these killers.
Yep.
And sometimes you just really have to like be very actively pushing yourself to do the right thing, because it can be so easy just to like brush it under the rug and be like, nope, I am not getting involved in whatever the hell is going on over there.
Or like you said, convince yourself that it was nothing.
Yeah.
Or like, oh yeah, no, that's not a big detail.
It
probably has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Michael had disposed of almost all of Holly's body parts. Almost, because he kept her legs. He said that he was too scared to make another trip, so he placed them in his refrigerator until he was able to dispose of them on garbage day. Investigators later found surveillance video that confirmed that Briere boarded the train twice, both times carrying bags. Steve Ryan said, quote, Briere sitting in a seat, a bag on the seat, and I remember thinking to myself, the subway was jam-packed with people, people with different stories of the day, someone who got a promotion, somebody who got a new car, sold their house, bought a new puppy, killed a young girl and dismembered her body. To watch it, to see him going about his everyday regular routine and other people going about their routines as well, but their routines are so different. They came from so many different places. His, Briere, came from hell. These other people, everyday life. But they had no idea what was on that subway car with them. End quote.
And it's terrifying to think about. You do not know the people who are around you.
Terrific.
You don't know what they're capable of. You don't know, you know, the types of things that they fantasize about. And this is somebody who you could be sitting right next to, appears completely normal. And yet here we are. There's a fucking child's body inside a bag.
Just knowing that I had passed somebody on the street that had that, it is horrifying.
That fact on its own would haunt me forever.
Investigators believe that Briere likely assumed that the remains would find themselves in the middle of the lake and never be found. If this had happened, it would have likely been nearly impossible to find Holly Jones's murderer. The DNA evidence that connected Holly to her killer was crucial. In regards to Briere and killers in general, Steve Ryan also said, quote, They are so self-centered. Everything is about them. And once the deed is done, now it's again self-preservation. What do I do now? How do I get rid of this evidence? I'll take it on the subway with all regular, normal day people. End quote.
Did he not have a car?
No, he didn't have a car.
Okay.
Following the arrest of the 35-year-old software developer, a bill was created called Holly's Law. The bill was meant to improve funding as well as investigative authority for monitoring and keeping tabs on those who develop software, as well as other technology professionals such as laptop designers, electrical technicians, and computer repairmen. Some members of the community were outraged by this bill. So, he developed software, just didn't sit well with some people. I don't believe Holly's family was involved in creating this law, and there's actually another law that they tried to create themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the whole idea here was, like, people who have access and deep access to computers, like, we need to keep tabs on them.
I love that.
I just think if you're not doing anything wrong.
Exactly.
Why do you care?
And, like, there's a lot of cases that show, especially when it comes to child predators, that they are very, very technologically inclined. And you have to be.
Right.
If you're accessing the dark web and looking up child sex abuse material, I don't believe that's an easy thing to do. It's not like you hop on Google and type in a couple words and up comes these sites. It's not that easy. You have to get special browsers and all kinds of stuff. It's not like you have to kind of know what you're doing.
Right.
And people who are very, very techie, they know what they're doing. Same thing with these people who have these like NordVPNs on their computers and shit. Like, I know people have those for legitimate reasons, but to me, immediately, I'm like, what are you trying to hide?
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, what are those things actually meant for? Like, who actually needs a fucking VPN on their computer or on their devices?
The only thing that I know of that people use it for is either accessing, like, let's say, like, Netflix and what is on Netflix from another country. So, like, there might be something on American Netflix that we don't have here. Or sometimes, like, for example, in schools, the Wi-Fi, when you're connected to the Wi-Fi, it blocks social media. So it will block, like, Facebook and it will block Instagram and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The kids want to scroll through these things. So they have a VPN, which allows them to access the Wi-Fi and also for their phone or whatever it is to not know where they're browsing from,
mm-hmm.
so that they can still access. So there's innocent reasons for it, but also, yes, I'm sure there are people using that.
It's
weird.
It just does not sit well with me. Even if I was a parent and it was my child who had a VPN on their phone, I'd kind of be like, I'm not really loving the fact that, like, nobody knows what you're browsing. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, it just seems very, very secretive. And even with these browsers nowadays, you can go on, like, incognito and, like, vanish mode and all this shit. It's like, why do these exist? Like, it actually bothers me.
I know.
Because unless you're trying to fucking hide something, there's no need for it.
Yeah, the promotion of ways to be anonymous.
I don't like it. Like, I don't like it.
Especially on the internet. It's like Reddit and, like, why are you promoting people just going haywire and saying and doing whatever the heck they want with no accountability?
Yeah, I don't agree with it. I think that you should have the freedom to have your privacy, absolutely. But there's a difference between that and actively pursuing ways to be completely incognito, even from, like, police presence. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, that you're kind of taking it to a new level now.
Yes.
So this Holly's Law, like, that's an actual thing?
I'm not sure. It was a bill. And okay. I don't know if it was passed or if it's still a thing in Toronto, and it may not have ever been followed through with, depending.
Yeah.
But I think that everybody should have tabs kept on them in regards to child sex abuse.
Yeah.
I think everybody, I know it's probably an impossible task.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it does make sense to me. If you are tech savvy and you have access to all of these things, it does make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And obviously you don't want to stereotype, because, like, we know that not everyone who's tech savvy is on the dark web.
I would say most people, like, aren't.
That's an obvious thing here, right? But, like, for the small amount of people that are, I think it's an amazing idea for them to be a little bit more closely monitored, right? And if you've got nothing to hide, then that really should not bother you.
Or if it's something, you know, if it's anything other than to do with harming children, then, you know, we're just going to mind our business. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Michael Briere waived his rights to a preliminary hearing and chose to plead guilty. His sentencing hearing took place in the same courtroom where Paul Bernardo was convicted in 1995. Prior to Michael Briere's appearance in court, Chief Crown Attorney Paul Culver and Attorney Hank Goody completed the statement of facts. It was a 61-page document. They visited the Joneses' family home and presented the information to Holly's parents to prepare them for what they would hear in the courtroom. Holly's mother was not yet aware of the details of her daughter's abduction and murder, and the attorneys had to pause a handful of times to give Holly's parents a break from the horrific details. Just a couple of days later, on June 17, 2004, Michael Briere was charged with Holly Jones's murder, just over 1 year later. He pleaded guilty to first-degree murder. Briere addressed the courtroom in Toronto, indicating that he blamed his actions on watching child sex abuse material on the internet. He said, quote, "The crime I am guilty of is simply the worst kind of crime a person can commit. What I did was absolutely wrong. It was done out of selfishness. It was the act of a coward. I accept the sentence which you are about to give me. No one who has stood in front of you has been more deserving of such a sentence. I stand by my words when I told the police a man who commits these crimes, you put away. You put away for good. I take no pride in what I have done. The truth is, I am ashamed beyond belief. I regret everything. I'm really sorry. I really wish I could undo everything. I have failed as a human being." End quote. He also characterized what he had done as cruel, inhuman, and nightmarish, and indicated that he wanted to avoid a trial so as not to cause Holly's family pain.
I wonder if that was his choice or if it was his attorney's choice, because they knew that there was no way he would be getting away with this. And I'm wondering if he's actually
remorseful.
The words come across as remorse to me.
It does. But I don't really give a flying.
Yes, agree.
To be honest.
And you fantasized about it, right?
You knew it was wrong.
You knew it was wrong.
You kept consuming child sex abuse material.
You had the fucking forethought to sit there and be like, should I act on it? Should I not? Should I act on it? Should I not? Nope. Today's the day. I'm going to go out and do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like you just suddenly got possessed and something came over you. You know, one day you woke up and you just, you know, day one started watching child sex abuse material. And that day you just happened to go out and abduct and kill a child. That's not how it works. There's a process to it. You clearly were consuming this content for God knows how long.
Right. I mean, he's 35. So
you knew it was wrong, and he's sitting here blaming his actions on him watching child sex abuse material.
It's like, but you watched it, but you did it.
Nobody forced you to do that. And also, watching it does not force people to go out and commit the act, nor does it force people to kill somebody. You right. have that messed up quality. It was your actions that led you to do the things that you did.
Yeah.
So let's not try to deflect it and blame it on some type of material on the internet.
Yeah.
It's your fault. You did this.
You were in control. Holly's mother, Maria, was present for the sentencing. However, her father, George, was not. He indicated that he would not have been able to control himself when he laid eyes on the man responsible for murdering his daughter. Maria said, quote, "I do recall going to the courtroom and promising myself, I won't look him in the face, because I didn't want to see his face, because I feared that that face will never leave my head," end quote.
I can't imagine the feeling of being in the same room as a person who committed an act like that, especially against your own child. It must be such a mind fuck.
I am sort of with her dad on this one, and I don't know how I would be able to control myself either.
You wouldn't be able to.
During the reading of the agreed upon statement of facts, the murder was described, which included the details of how Briere abducted Holly by grabbing her neck, sexually assaulted her in his bedroom, then proceeded to murder her and dismember and dispose of her body shortly after downloading and viewing child sex abuse material on his computer. During Michael Briere's initial confession to police, he spoke specifically about the accessibility of child sex abuse material, saying, quote, "The simplicity of getting material, it's close to mind-boggling. I've never understood how come the whole thing wasn't shut down, just because of the nature of it. You search for the word baby, and it will find stuff there. It's easy. You don't need a degree. I don't know how it is for other people, but for myself, I would say that yes, viewing the material does motivate you to do other things. The more I saw it, the more I long for it in my heart," end quote. Which again, no.
This was back in, what, 2003, right?
Yeah.
So I feel like things were probably a lot easier to access back then.
I hope it's not that easy.
I don't think it is. Well, I mean, he says he's browsing the dark web in 2003. I didn't even know the dark web existed back then, but clearly that's me just being naive.
Yeah, I would say it's existed for a long time.
Yeah. But I would think with like how technology has advanced, there will probably be ways that are harder to access these things. I would pray to God, but that's just me being hopeful. Like, I really hope it's not as easy to access as he's going on.
I know.
Like, it can't be.
It says the dark web is known to have begun in 2000.
Wow.
And it started with the release of Freenet, which was a thesis project of a university student who set out to create a, quote, distributed, decentralized information storage and retrieval system. He wanted to create a new way to anonymously communicate and share files online, which, like, why did you want to do that, Ian?
Right, exactly.
Don't love it.
Yeah.
Crown attorney Paul Culver said, quote, "As remorseful as he appeared in court today, he didn't turn himself in. This wasn't a situation where he said sorry until the police nailed him with overwhelming DNA odds. Mr. Briere, whatever else motivated him, was spurred on by images of child pornography downloaded from the internet. If this isn't a case that brings home to society, to government, to legislatures, and to those involved in the prosecution and resolution of child pornography cases, that this cancer on our society must be stopped and stamped out, then I can't think of one," end quote. Apologies that it used pornography there, but it's a direct quote, and that's the term they used then. The Joneses' family lawyer read a victim impact statement on behalf of Holly's mother, which read, quote, "May 12, 2003, at approximately 6:30 p.m., our daughter was unwillingly taken away from us and murdered. Since this day, our lives have changed forever. It would be impossible for me, as Holly's mother, to express in a short period of time how this has so impacted our family. It is also very difficult to express the pain that now lives inside of us, the torture of having to wake up every morning, the torture of the emptiness that we now live with in our home. You can only try to imagine the nightmare. The agony of having to see her bedroom door reminding us that her bed will always stay empty. The family pictures that hang throughout our home is just another painful reminder of knowing there will never be another family picture to add to our collection. A reminder of where she is and how she got there. Never to hear her say the words mommy or I love you ever again. This person that appears in court today has affected all of our family's hearts in a way no one can imagine. I live with a fear that surrounds me day after day. It is complete agony to know that Holly's brother and sister will also have to live with this nightmare for the rest of their lives. My children now have different parents. I am unable to be the mother they once knew. It is a daily struggle and fight to continue as a mother, but my children are the reason why I felt I must keep on going. I have many beautiful memories of Holly and clearly remember her most beautiful smile. However, my memory is now distorted. Our last memory of Holly is of her lying in her coffin, knowing that her body parts were there, however her legs were missing. I know that I will never attend another funeral, a christening, or a child's birthday party. Some of my very good friends have children that were Holly's close friends. It is very difficult to see them now knowing that we will never get together as a family anymore. That you could only imagine that agony of our own family functions and to see and hear Holly's cousins. It especially breaks my heart to see my 10-year-old niece, her distraught face when looking at me, both painfully so aware of the absence that surrounds us. Mother and Father's Day will never be the same. There is a sickness that now lives inside my stomach. pain that lives in my heart, horror in my mind, and a hell that surrounds my body. We know that we will never get that complete feeling of happiness again. This person has made us suffer for the rest of our lives. Sadness will now live with us forever. There can be no closure for us here today. We will always continue to think of Holly every waking moment. Our hope is that Holly's tragic death will not be an end, but a beginning. Our demand is that Holly's life and legacy will live on past this day. End quote.
The pain that these people must be living with is incomprehensible. Like, I literally just had to detach while you were reading that because I can't even imagine.
I had to detach while reading it as well to think about going on after that. And she's right. The only thing that could keep you going are your children that you have there that you love.
Mm-hmm.
But you would never be the same again. Judge David Watt addressed Briere saying, quote, "Your crime profoundly shocked this community and city. And it is a community that is no longer easily shocked by crimes of violence. A random abduction on a quiet city street, a sexual assault, a murder, dismemberment, a young active life, like others, full of promise, snuffed out. There seems no bottom in the depravity pool, nor any limits to the vulnerability of our children." End quote.
And that's the thing with crimes like this is the ripple effect. Like, it doesn't just affect the family. The people in the community who even have to hear a whisper of this on the news, something to this level of trauma, deeply, deeply affects you.
It would stay with you forever.
Like, I remember hearing stories locally about things that went on when I was younger that stuck with me. And I can still remember how I felt in those moments where you just feel sick to your stomach. And it's like,
it's dread.
Yeah. And it's like a worm in your brain that, like, you can't get it out.
Yeah.
And that's, it just taints everybody in the community. It shakes the entire community forever. Mm-hmm. And that's all from one sick fuck's actions.
It is. Due to his guilty plea, Michael Briere was automatically sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole for 25 years. So in Canada, that's what life means, 25 years. And then after that 25 years is where he would be able to apply for parole, potentially. This past May, it had been 20 years since Holly Jones' death. She would be 30 years old today. From the most up-to-date information that I could find, Michael Briere, who is now 55 years old, currently resides in a Quebec prison and is only 5 years away from being eligible to apply for full parole in 2028. He is apparently eligible to apply for day parole in 2025.
I wonder if they'll let him out.
I hope not. If he's actually as remorseful as he said he was and he actually wants to be locked up for good, hopefully he shuts it down himself.
He won't. It'll be up to the judge to decide if he stays, because at that point I'm sure he'll think like, oh, I did my time and I'm recovered now. And
there is no amount of time that somebody who sexually abuses a child can do that will satisfy what I believe should be done.
Her parents must just be feeling sick knowing that date is coming up.
It's around the corner.
And he's only 55. Like, I don't know what I was expecting. I thought, like, by now he would be an old man, but a 55-year-old is plenty capable of coming out of jail and acting out another crime.
And he would probably run right back to it. Because no, these people don't become rehabilitated.
No.
A neighbor of Holly's friend Claudia said, quote, "Her schoolmates, teachers, and everyone in the neighborhood and beyond will never ever forget this horrific tragedy and the monster behind it. We don't want this evil man back on our streets terrorizing families and children." End quote. This woman created a petition on change.org where almost 5,000 people have signed to express their outrage and deny Michael Briere's release when he applies for parole. If you want to sign it, I believe you can just type his name, Michael Briere, and write change.org and it'll come up.
I'll be signing that one.
Yep. In regards to Michael Briere, Maria, Holly's mother, said, quote, "I don't like to spend too much time talking about that monster, especially even one thought of him. I never spend time thinking about his release. However, it does enter into my mind once in a while. It definitely is not a conversation my husband and I have yet. It's important for the public to remember, and I feel very sure that we would have, again, a ton of support from everyone with denying his parole and keeping him locked up." End quote. And this part, again, it's just so traumatizing for the families and the people connected to this case to have to relive it when the time comes. It's sick, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, you can never, it would always be at the back of your mind.
Yeah. And I know things like victim impact statements can help keep a perpetrator behind bars. But I'm wondering if something as simple as a petition from a bunch of strangers in the community would hold any weight to a judge. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
I feel like it wouldn't hurt.
It definitely wouldn't hurt. But I would hope that a judge would really, really heavily take that into consideration. Whether the people know this man personally or not, or know the family personally or not, they're putting their names behind a cause that is very meaningful to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that should mean something in the grand scheme of things. Legally, I don't know if it really counts much in terms of keeping somebody behind bars, like a change.org petition. Like, I don't really know how that stuff works. I don't know how many signatures you technically need to actually make a difference.
But the decision in itself, it has to be somewhat subjective, because there's no rule book to, like, oh, hey, have they done XYZ, check off these boxes? Oh, have they done XYZ, check off these boxes? You're paroled.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I feel like if I'm a judge and you raped and sodomized and killed a child, dismembered her body, you're never getting paroled by me, ever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if you come crying and showing me all this evidence of work you've done and how you've changed. I literally do not give a shit.
Right.
I will never. So I don't know. Is there a subjective component to it? It must be, because it's a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, it is. It depends on the judge.
And so I just hope that the judge is like, just scoffs at him and is like, go on back to your cell, saunter back into the private custody that they got you in so you don't get murdered.
I hope to God that happens, and I would love to see the look on his face when he gets his parole denied. And I hope he gets his hopes up right before it gets denied, too.
I do, too. And I'll shed a little booty hoo for him.
Booty fucking hoo, bro.
Michael Breer's ex-wife spoke on an episode of Crime Beat saying, quote, "I first met Michael Breer in 1993, and my first impression was he was funny, he was charming, kind of looked like a young Dustin Hoffman, and seemed like a good guy to be around. We wanted to be together. We were inseparable. There was even talk of children at one point, and he proposed. And he said, well, let's just go to Las Vegas. We got married at the Chapel of Love. I noticed over time, and it wasn't a long time, but it started to really show that Michael was drifting away a bit. He didn't want to go out as much anymore, and he didn't want to do the usual things anymore. And then he wanted to start playing more video games." End quote. So Breer's ex-wife, they weren't together at the time, she received a phone call from the media in June of 2003, and a reporter indicated, you know, your ex-husband has been arrested in association with this case. And she described the feeling when she got that phone call by saying, quote, "It was like hot poison lava poured into my stomach. I think there was a lot he was hiding from me, because I don't think that someone who ends up doing something like that just happens." End quote. She concluded the interview by saying, quote, "If I could say anything to the victim's family, it would be, I'm so sorry for your tremendous loss." End quote. I also cannot imagine if I had learned that a previous partner did something like this.
I would just want to crawl out of my body.
I was going to say, I think I'd want to just peel my skin off.
Yeah.
That it's repulsive.
Mm-hmm.
In the neighborhood and surrounding areas where Holly and her family once resided, there remain murals and memorial benches created to honor her life. In the heaviness and sadness of Holly's murder, her parents, Maria and George, separated. Holly's mom, Maria, said, quote, "It tore us all apart. We all went in our own directions, even the kids," end quote. And this is something that's really common that happens when a couple's child gets murdered. that they'll be angry and they'll blame each other, and a lot of the times they'll separate because it just is, it's devastating.
Yeah.
I think I learned this on an episode of Criminal Minds because there was some case on the show where the parents were involved in the death of the child, or they were trying to cover it up. And one of the things they noted was that the couple was still really, really affectionate and like protective of each other and like still being super loving, which is not something that they commonly see, because a lot of the time they end up alienating themselves from one another because it's just too hard.
Mm-hmm.
However, 4 years after Holly's death, the family came back together. So they essentially came to the conclusion that they could only get through this together.
Oh, wow.
And although they have done their best to move forward, Holly's mother says that the lows never get easier.
That's amazing that they were able to come back together, though. Like, I feel like that's
even harder.
Very rare.
Yes.
Yeah. But thank God, though.
10 years following Holly's murder, her siblings resided in their old neighborhood. Her older sisters lived just up the street, and her older brother lived right across the street from their family home. At the time, Holly's parents also still resided in their home, and they had a cupboard of Holly's things to remember her by. So I don't know if they still live there. I wasn't able to find updated information, but they did for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Holly's mother said, quote, "I want her to be remembered as the angel that she was. It's true sadness when it becomes hard to look at a picture of your child or think of a memory. However, with that said, we keep the pictures throughout our home, but I think we avoid looking at them, although I want to." So here's a picture of, it's a little bit grainy, but this is Holly and her mom and dad.
You can just tell she just has such a, like, bright soul.
Oh, yeah. She's just
so innocent.
Yeah. And then here is a Toronto Sun. So this is the front page of the newspaper. And the title is Rotten Hell. Holly Jones's killer pleads guilty, admits kid porn fueled murder. And there was 12 pages of coverage of this case in this.
Oh, wow. Well, it's pretty unbelievable when something like that happens.
Holly's mother and father eventually married in Holly's memorial garden in the backyard of their family home. Quote, "It was more than a wedding, because all our friends knew what we went through, with Holly splitting up, going our own ways, the anger, the troubles, that it was like an ending, you know, a good ending to a really big story," end quote. At St. Luigi Catholic School, there is an award in memory of Holly Jones, and it goes to a student who exemplifies her zest for life. Recently, just before it marked 20 years since her daughter's life was taken, in an interview with the Toronto Sun, Holly's mother said, quote, "For many years, we would get together as a family on the 12th of May for Holly. But over the years, the kids growing up, we combined Mother's Day with honoring Holly's memory. However, on May 12th, George and I bring her out to the living room or backyard with us with a picture and a candle. She stays on my bedside table. It's always a difficult day because it's too hard and sad to think about the horror she suffered. So we find ourselves distracting with other conversations so to avoid thinking about it," end quote.
And May 12th, that was the day that she was abducted, right?
Right.
And I'm pretty sure that's, like, right around Mother's Day.
Yeah, it is.
What a brutal time of year.
I know. She also said, quote, "Our family get-togethers fill our hearts, and we are a busy Nona and Papa when we are together. Again, for all of us, it is too difficult to talk about Holly. But I know it's a thought in everyone's head and a sad emptiness in everyone's hearts. We all just keep that to ourselves," end quote. In an interview with CBC, in regards to her daughter, Maria said, quote, "She's everywhere. She's the birds in the morning when I come out on the deck. She's our cat sometimes. She's everywhere. You know, you have to try to grasp whatever you can, obviously. You don't have her physically anymore, but you can imagine where she could be. If she's truly an angel, she could be anywhere, correct? I don't know. That's my feelings, and that's what I grab hold of, and that's all I can hang on to," end quote. When Holly's parents were asked what others should learn from what happened to their child, Holly's mother said, quote, "Many people have said this to me, that they've taken their relationship with their child for granted. Now they make a point of the I love you, the kissing and the hugging and the good nights," end quote. Holly's father, George, said, quote, "Keep an eye on your kids. Keep a better eye on your children. I didn't. Hopefully then people will. Now, spend just a little more time watching, wondering what their children are doing, you know? people take a lot of things for granted, unfortunately. I did, end quote.
And that's just so important to really, really focus on what your kids are doing. Like, I don't care how old my children get. I truly believe that I'm always, always going to be worrying about their whereabouts and what they're doing.
Of course.
And I feel as though there are some parents who don't do that all the time. And they're just kind of like, oh, whatever. Like, my kid's out of my hair. Like, I don't care where they're at. And like, you know, they're old enough. I don't need to worry about them anymore. But you can just never be too certain about what your kids are doing or who, or even who they're surrounding themselves with.
Mm-hmm.
And your kid could be the most responsible, trustworthy, you know, well-rounded kid. But that only can take them so far in life. Like, the people that they surround themselves with are huge influences on who they end up becoming as people. And sometimes that can be their friends. It could be their friend's parents. It could just be the creepy guy from down the street.
Mm-hmm. It just takes one person.
Yeah.
Whether it be someone who leads them down a wrong path, or whether it be just the one person that they come across with their guard down who hurts them.
Yeah.
It's a line that you sort of have to straddle of not helicoptering, but also being careful. And it's really, really hard as a parent to find that line.
Yeah, I think it's just educating your kids, being hyper aware, making them hyper aware, and just
giving them all the tools that you can give them.
Yeah, giving them these scenarios and this is what you should do if this were to ever happen. And, you know, even for my kids, they're almost 2 and just turned 4. And my 4-year-old, he's now at the age where he can memorize our home address. He can memorize my phone number. He can memorize, you know, his grandparents' names and their addresses and phone numbers. And he knows what 911 is, you know, all of that stuff. Hopefully he'll never have to
use a
reason.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes me feel better knowing that my child, if I'm not there, if there's ever an emergency, he knows how to dial 911. He knows how to tell police where he's at. He knows how to get home. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, oh yeah, that's so
those
important.
Little things are so important. And it doesn't matter how old your kid is, whether they're 4 years old, whether they're 10 years old, whether they're an 18-year-old, right? Like, kids are naive. They mm-hmm. don't know these things.
Oh, and their brain isn't developed enough for them to truly understand.
Right.
And you have to keep that in mind as a parent as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, just give them the tools and the resources that that will help them.
Right.
If they come across some sort of situation like that.
Yeah.
Detective Steve Ryan expresses that he wished that Holly had screamed for help as Briere grabbed her by the neck during the abduction. He said, quote, "I recall him saying to the officers that had she screamed, I would have let her go." The detective says, "Tell parents to tell their kids if they are abducted to scream because he would have let her go," end quote. Which I think I've mentioned this on a previous episode, was something that my mother drilled into my head my entire life, that if somebody has a gun pointed or a knife or is trying to take you, you scream, you kick, you punch, you do everything in your power to get away from that person,
mm-hmm.
because wherever you're going, it's worse
it's not gonna end well.
What's happening right now.
Yeah. And even if you don't feel comfortable screaming, another thing that I heard is to yell fire.
Right.
Because more people are willing to respond to somebody screaming for help if there's a fire somewhere.
Right.
Rather than if somebody is just screaming because they're being attacked, people aren't as ready and willing to jump on helping a situation like that.
Especially if they're vulnerable. It makes
sense. Yeah, which, you know, so if you scream fire, you'll get more people's attention. And yeah, that's another great piece of advice to teach your kids, is just don't clam up and be quiet. As much as that's probably your initial reaction sometimes, mm-hmm. it's
like,
okay.
You're not my mommy. You're not my dad. This isn't my mommy. This isn't my daddy. And scream.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, her parents may have told her that. We're not certain.
Right.
This is clearly not to blame any sort of victim.
Absolutely not.
Rather just to give steps of like, what can we do to help our kids?
Yeah.
When asked about what they miss most about their daughter, Holly's dad said, quote, "Holly, comfort, hugs, lying on the couch, watching TV, everything. I miss so much about her. That's not a simple question, not a simple answer. I miss her. I miss her so much. End quote. Her mother said, quote, we were friends, her and I. We did so many things. I'll tell you something Holly and I said to each other in secret was that she was my best friend and I was her best friend. But we promised that we're going to keep that a secret because we don't want any of our real best friends to know about it. But we'll always have that with each other. So I miss my best friend. End quote. After her murder, Holly's family worked hard to create Holly's Law. So this is different than the one I spoke about before. This was a law which stated that there are some offenders in prison that can just never be rehabilitated. So this law was meant to identify the population of sex offenders and predators and to have applications that would place these offenders in this category. And essentially what this would do was to keep them in prison until it was deemed that they were rehabilitated. And if they never were, they could never get out. So these offenders would still be allowed a trial and they could have their case reviewed. Although this law never came to fruition, the work that Holly's mother put in helped to create a national sex offender registry, which is pretty amazing.
So there was never a sex offender registry until her mother got involved?
Not a national sex offender registry.
Wow.
And she helped to fight for it along with, it was other people as well, but she was one of them.
And then this law where some people can never be rehabilitated, that was never passed.
Unfortunately, no. I think it should be a law everywhere, though. It sort of just goes along with what we were talking about. It's like, some of you will never, ever be able to put in the work to fix what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You just won't.
Well, they're like wild animals, right? If a dog bites a child or viciously, horrifically attacks a child, what happens? The dog gets put down. So why should we be keeping these people alive?
It's crazy, too, because dogs don't even have the cognitive capacity to understand when they attack or when they bite.
Right.
And within a second, they're put down. But with people, it's like, oh, let's give them some empathy. That's a child. What was the word? That's a
minor attracted person.
Like, please. These people are knowingly causing harm and killing defenseless, vulnerable children. They do not deserve to breathe the same air.
No, let alone have the chance to get back out into society.
To like, what, to like go to the grocery store and like that be around me, kids again? Like, no, that is so irresponsible.
That to me is a joke. Like, if you want to act like a wild animal, you should be treated like a wild animal. And, you know, if they're not going to euthanize child predators, like in my opinion, they should be.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we use these people for, instead of doing animal testing, why don't we cage these freaks up and pour some acid on them and just let them suffer? Like, that's what should be happening here.
Like, it's, I mean, and I know it's, we're making light of it and we're saying this, but it's like, there is just so many other things. The whole idea is like, it should not be back on the streets.
No.
This is the main point we're getting across here.
They should
not be back in society where they can blend in, where, oh, okay, yeah, they're put on a list. I don't know. What's the list for my area? I should probably know that. Is there one? You know what I mean? Like, right. What is the consequence?
If they are put back out into society, it should be public knowledge. Their identity should not be concealed. They should not be able to have anonymity and just, yeah, like you said, be right back into society. Like, it's not like it is here in Canada, like it is in America, where there's a national sex offender registry where that anybody can access.
Yeah.
There's literally a map that you can bring up of your neighborhood and it will show you pinpoints of where the child sex offenders live, where people who have been accused of assault live.
Right.
You know,
and not to mention, in the United States, the sentences actually, for the most part, in terms of child sex abuse, are a lot harsher than here.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the sentences that I've seen here are absolutely shameful. And that's, again, in Hunting Warhead. because that child sex abuser was caught in the United States, he was sentenced in the United States. And if he had been sentenced here, he might be walking free right now. Yeah. And for what? Like, who are we showing empathy for? Who are we forgiving? That doesn't deserve to be forgiven.
Not to mention, what kind of example are you setting for these other people where there's no consequence? Like, serving 6 years in jail for doing the most horrific, disgusting, unimaginable things to a child.
And then you have people who were in possession of, like, marijuana at one point that probably did more than that. It's really, really mind-boggling, it's honestly backwards. And it's that's a topic for another day.
It's backwards, but yeah, our point here is that these people should not be allowed back out, especially when they do something as heinous and as fucked up as what this guy did. Like, it shouldn't even be. I know the law is the law, and I know you're entitled to your parole.
Oh, blah blah blah.
But
not this guy. Sorry.
At the end of the day. Like, there, and honestly, and I don't even want to put it out into the universe, but we'll see how this all pans out. He better stay locked the hell up, because there's going to be some riots out in the street. And if he does get out, he better move and live in the woods, because he'll never survive a day out in society.
Well, he's from Quebec, so maybe he can find Paul Bernardo's ex-wife.
Oh, my dear God.
Or maybe he'll just be, you know, frolicking the daycare like she does.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine?
No.
Yeah, this is where we need the vigilantes to step up and get some shit done.
Dexter.
Oh,
where
my
are
God.
You?
Yeah.
We need a literally. We need a Dexter Quebecois.
I mean, I'm sure there's a little Dexter of some sorts in Quebec, hopefully. So.
Dexter.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry. Okay. If you're looking for more information, more information on this case, there is an Investigation Discovery episode called Blood in the Water, and that's for the series The Lake Erie Murders, and that aired in 2019. So that would be on, what's that app that has ID?
I think it's called
ID.
Investigation Discovery.
Yeah, okay. And then,
or Discovery Plus.
Yes, there we go. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
There is a podcast called The Detective, where they go into detail and do interviews with some of the detectives on this case. It's more journalism with interviews. And finally, there is also a really good episode of this on Crime Beat, which is a podcast as well, but this is the TV show, which is on Amazon Prime, and it's on season 3, episode 26, and it's similar to like a documentary where they have the parents talking and photos, and it's more of like a, you know, movie style version of the story that I just told, and I sort of compiled a bunch of resources, so there likely won't be anything new on there because I tried to get everything in here, but it's still good to sort of reference the pictures and the videos and to see everything.
I still like to like watch these documentaries and stuff.
Yes.
Just to like see, because it's different, you know, seeing the actual people involved speaking about things and seeing, you know, the pictures and the reenactments or the reactions of, you know, it's a whole different sort of vibe. So. Definitely very interesting.
Yeah. That is all I've got. I shouldn't say all. Thankfully, that's all I've got.
Yeah.
That was heavy.
Crazy, crazy story.
Thankfully,
unreal.
With an ending that put that guy where he belongs. Mm-hmm. Hopefully he stays there.
Yeah.
Doesn't always turn out that way. But I'm not sure what our plan is for the next case.
Yeah, we have yet to decide.
It would be a tag team.
Yeah.
That's the schedule that we're on right now.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can put a little poll on Instagram or something.
Yes. I don't know if you're super familiar with the Menendez brothers case.
Yes.
But I've been sort of getting back into that one because, if you don't know, Netflix is releasing season 2 of Monsters, which the first one was Dahmer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a little controversial, but the series was extremely well done.
Yeah.
And season 2 will be the Menendez brothers.
Okay. Amazing.
And that is a, that's a whole can of worms that it would take us a long time to open. So
I know like bits and pieces of the story, but psyched for that one regardless, because I know the acting will be phenomenal.
Yeah. Depending on how you feel about it, it's either very cut and dry or it's psychologically complex or it falls somewhere in the middle, which, but
right.
I've been sort of listening to, there's not a ton out there, honestly.
Really?
Not for podcasts. Okay. So,
yeah.
But yeah, we're not going to do the Menendez brothers because I think that's just a little bit too much.
We can do it one day.
One day, just not right now.
We'll wait till the show comes out and then maybe we'll revisit that idea. But
yeah, maybe we'll do a little poll.
Yeah.
And find another one to tag team.
We'll do a deep dive into another crazy story for you guys.
I think the last one that we tag team was Picton.
Was it really? No. Yeah. Joseph Paul Franklin.
Oh, did we tag team that one? I missed that one.
But the one before that was Picton.
It was Picton, and that was a lot.
Yeah.
We just wanted to just crawl in bed and never come out after we did that one.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of really, really good, like, higher profile cases that I really want to tag team, because it's just, even though some of them have been told a million times, it's still, you just still never get tired of hearing these crazy, crazy stories.
There are some local ones that we're going to get to, but I feel like because it's so close to home, like, we just, the pressure is on even more to do a good job.
Yeah.
And we have potential for, like, maybe another RCMP interview and things like that, and I just don't have the mental capacity right now
right
to do that. So and for those of you who may not have seen on social media, probably only a select few of you have, I am pregnant with another boy.
Yay, congrats.
And so that'll make four
momicide babies.
They don't even know, but
oh my gosh,
if they don't like true crime, it's okay.
Yeah. Oh my god. I was just gonna ask if you were gonna announce it on the pod. So here we are. Surprise. Yeah. Amanda's pregnant. Amanda's pregnant. And how many weeks are you now?
I'm 16. Yeah. And the little boy is due to come on Christmas Day.
Oh my god. A little Christmas baby. Oh.
Yeah.
I'm so happy for you.
So I was struggling a little bit there with the first trimester. Just nausea and exhaustion. I'm out of the woods now, so
feeling good. There's honestly nothing worse than feeling like that and still having to function. And so, I mean, God bless Amanda. She's continued pulling it all together and editing our episodes and being present and all that. Meanwhile, you guys had no idea she was going through the most. So,
yep. And here we are. And last episode, I was like in the thick of it, and I was like, the first 8 minutes deleted or something stupid. And I'm like,
my god. I know, I felt so bad for you.
Anyway, we will be backing this up a few times to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
But anyway, GarageBand, why would a random segment just delete itself?
Oh my god.
Why is that a glitch?
Who knows? Yeah, you would really think by now these things just would not be happening, but
here we are.
Yeah. Good old technology.
Well, thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
See you guys next time.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.